Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to the Percussion Loft, the podcast from Gonbops, the leading percussion instrument manufacturer since 1954. I'm Rich Mangiacaro. So glad you could join us as we hear from the world's greatest drummers and percussionists. Let's get started. That great shuffle we were just listening to is from my guest today, Mr. Tony Bronigal, on a track called That's What Keeps Me Rockin' from Robert Cray, a track he played on some years back. Tony is best known as a session drummer and percussionist on over 200 albums, including those of Otis Rush, Eric Burdon, Johnny Nash, and Buddy Guy, as well as appearing on the Grammy-winning albums of Bonnie Raitt and Taj Mahal. He's performed live with dozens of icons, including Bonnie Raitt, Ricky Lee Jones, B.B. King, John Lee Hooker, Lyle Lovett, Taj Mahal, and the Blues Brothers, just to name a few. As a well-respected producer, Tony's created award-winning recordings and has been nominated for the BMA in the Best Instrumentalist category, Drums, 12 times, winning it in 2018. Tony's a longtime artist endorsee for Gonbops. Tony, when you were growing up in Texas, your influence was heavy in country music, I think I remember reading, and I'm wondering how you made that transition from country into your love for blues music that you've been working in for so long.
It's a particular story, indeed. My father was into country music, and that's all we kind of listened to around the house. And you know, when he handed me a guitar and taught me how to play three chords, you know, G, C, D, I was just strumming like you would if you were playing a country song. That's about the best I could do on the guitar. And I had a cousin by the name of Betty, and she would babysit me every once in a while. That wasn't very often, but she would, and it would be just me and her, and she'd be doing her housework or whatever. She was about 7 or 8 years older than I. And she was playing music from the African-American stations in Houston, KYOK and KCOH. And she had the radio blaring. It, which was very odd for anybody in our family. I was listening to this music, and it made me move a certain way. And I went, wait a minute, there's something going on here. I like this. So I really started listening to it and got hooked onto it seriously, like secretively, you know, as well, like underneath everybody's nose. And so much to the point that at that age, my dad would let me back the car out from the garage out into the driveway to wash the car. And just so that I didn't mind doing the work of wash the car, just so that I could drive the car 30 feet backwards and then back up to the garage again, right? That was a big thrill for me at that age. I think I was about 11 or something like that, 10 or 11. And I would change the radio stations in the car, because back then they had buttons you pulled out. You dialed it with the dial, with the knob, and then you pull the button out, and then you locked it in. And so anytime you pressed, you could go to KILT, KCOH, KYOK, KNUZ. You know, you could go to all the stations you knew. And I put the two African-American stations on the last two buttons. And my best friend, who lived down the street, still my best friend, kind of like my big brother, Willie Arnelis, was he'd already started playing drums. He was a couple of years in, and he was ahead of me. So I would go down there, and he would let me tap around on the drum kit, because he was kind of cool about it. And we would listen to music. This was after school. Every day we'd go down, and we'd listen to all the greatest African-American music stars of the time. You know, one of our favorites, were like Bobby Bland and Ray Charles, you know, and then Stax Records became a big deal. And then, of course, Motown, which was the commercialized version of pretty much what came out of the church, you know what I mean, and became pop in the R&B scene. And I'm learning to play at the same time that I'm listening. And he's not really teaching me a lot by holding on, you know, pick up your hands and do this. He showed me how to hold my hands and he teach me to play this and play that, but he wasn't being really strict with me like a teacher would be.
That was my question. I was wondering if there's anybody else in your family that was musical that had influence on you.
I had a cousin, Sammy, who had a drum kit. He played, and my dad played guitar. And I think I had an uncle. I had an uncle that played guitar. And they would sit around at Christmas time and just play our family get-togethers or whatever. They were the music, and they would just play live old country classics and old folky tunes and stuff like that. And that, yeah, we were musical in that sense.
You just answered one of my next questions was I was going to ask you about Willie and how he influenced you, because I know you guys go way back. Was he would you say probably your first real influence as far as
Yes, clearly correct. Yes, absolutely. He was my first influence. I emulated Willie to be able to play, because you always start out emulating, right? I emulated Willie in a lot of ways. In fact, as I was coming up into the scene and starting to get out on gigs, some people would say, well, he plays a bit like Ornelas. You know what I mean? And I took that as a compliment, because sure, people like Willie, you know, so, yeah. and still do.
What was the scene like when you guys were coming up? Was it like local gigs in town kind of thing? Or was there school music involved, or how did that all...
I did band for one semester and I was in the marching band, and there were a bunch of rascals in at my school in the marching band. And when marching band went into the second semester, it went into stage band. So then we were inside the whole time. And so I was asked to be, the instructor said, he said, take this book home and Belwin Band Builder #1 and learn to read. And I'm going, why am I learning to read? You're supposed to teach me. But he wasn't teaching us anything. So I took the book home and I went through the first 4, 5, 6 pages. And I came back, you know, the next day. And he says, Mr. Barnagle, can you play anything? I said, yeah. I played 5 or 6 pages out of the book that I just taught myself. What, bat, 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 that kind of stuff. And he goes, okay, you're the first chair drummer. All right. I went, what does that mean? I felt good for a minute. Then I realized that there were a bunch of monkey heads in the drum section, and they would never stop talking and cutting up. And we were all the way at the top of the room. And I remember one fateful day when they wouldn't stop talking, and he yelled at me to keep, you know, to keep my section down. And I had already told him I couldn't do anything about it. And I made a rude gesture and walked out of the room. And I walked straight into the principal's office and asked her if she would mind. And I beat him down there and I closed the door. And I told her, I said, this guy's not teaching me anything. I'm not getting anything. I joined this class. I wanted to learn how to play music, and I want to learn music, and I'm not getting it. And he's teaching all the girls that are playing clarinet and trombone and stuff like that. And he's paying a lot of attention to them, but he's not paying any attention to us. And I said, I went out of the class, and he was knocking at the door already to come and tell her what I had done to him in front of the class, and which I wasn't ashamed of. Well, I guess I was a little bit. Well, I didn't want to get in trouble, but I wasn't ashamed of it. And so I switched over to typing. I took typing, which helped me out more than anything else than his instruction over right? the years, because now I can right. type, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's like I could type with not even looking at the keys, you know? And I thought, thank you, Mr. Fonz. I learned to type because of you. So that was the only thing that I did in school. But your question was what went on? What was the scene? There were nightclubs. And my very, very first gig was in a nightclub. And it was through Willie that I got the gig. And I've told this story so many times, Rich, and it's a very visual story, but I'll try to do it anyhow. We're sitting at Willie's house and we're discussing the fact that I'm going to buy my first drum kit from him. And it was going to cost me $100 if I could come up with the money in 7 days. If not, it was going to be $150. So I went out and sold my motor scooter for $45, walked back to the house, gave Willie the $45 as a down payment, they're mine. I'll have you the rest by next Saturday. And the phone rang, and he picked up the phone. And someone asks him if he could do a gig. And he says, no, I can't. I've already got a gig that night. And I knew that he did have a gig. And he said, and the guy said on the phone, do you know somebody else? And he looked across at me and he goes, yeah, I know somebody who can do a gig. I'm 15, Rich. I have not done a professional gig yet. He says, yeah, I know somebody. And he puts his hand over the receiver and he says, you want to do a gig? And I'm like, I have to ask my mom and dad first. So he said, well, all right, Charlie, I'll call you back a little bit later. He hangs up the phone. Willie says, you better go ask your parents. The pressure was on, man.
And that was it.
So I go down to the house and I got nothing but no's and no's and no's, son. Where is the place? I said, it's at Cross Timbers and Quitman. My dad goes, let's see, that's, well, son, that's a nightclub. And I said, yeah, yes, Dad, it's a nightclub. My son, they got a bar in there, they serve drinks, and there's people out nightclubbing and doing all that kind of stuff, you know? And I said, yes, I guess so, but there's music, you know, and they dance. Well, yeah, but see, you're only 15 years old. And I said, well, Dad, come on, I really want to do this. So I said, I'll be good, you know? So I went on and on and on. I wouldn't let him go. I badger. He goes, go ask your mom. So I go and I ask my mom. Mom's doing, saying, well, honey, you know, your dad's right. You're only 15, and we don't go back to your dad. So I go back to my dad. Finally, my dad says, okay, all right. He didn't say just this once, but he kind of said it like, all right, we'll see how this goes. He says, but here's the deal. You don't take any funny cigarettes from anybody, and you don't talk to any of the women. I said, Dad, I'm only 15. I don't know what you're talking about, you know? And so I went back to Willie's, and Willie called the guy back and says, yeah, I got you a drummer. And the guy goes, who is it? His name is Tony. He says, the deal is that you'll have to pick him up. He doesn't have a car. Well, Charlie goes, where do I pick him up at? Willie says, pick him up at my house, you know? He'll be waiting for you at 7 o'clock or whatever, you know, for an 8 o'clock gig. So we put the drums in the car and we're driving down the road, and the guy is being nice and asking me questions and now where have I been playing and da da da. And I said, well, I played at a sock hop at school and I played in my cousin's garage, and the guy goes, meanwhile, and the bass player, I have to add, is like in front of me in the front seat. I can't see him. I can only see the back of his head. And he goes, hey, this is Bob or whatever his name was. And so I get in the car and Charlie's asking me questions. And I said, well, and Charlie realizes this is my first gig. And he goes, I said, yeah, this is my first gig. And Charlie's like silent. And he laughs. And the bass player turns around. He's got a glass eye. And this is the funny part. It scared the shit out of me with this guy. I'm 15 and these guys are kind of grown up in their 20s or whatever. And the guy turns around and looks at me, you know, and I said, it was my first gig, and goes, no shit. With a glass eye. And I was like, oh my God, what am I doing? Where am I going? Take me back home, you know? I wasn't really scared, but it was alarming. And Charlie just starts laughing and says, that damn Dorn Ellis, man, he did it to us, boy. He got us. And I said, hey guys, I showed confidence. I know what I'm doing, you know? I can, he goes, you know how to play this beat and that beat? And I said, yeah, I know how to play 6/8, da da da. And I play a shuffle. I know that song. I know that instrumental. I know all those songs you're talking about because we had been studying. Just Willie and I have been listening.
You know, that's kind of rare, actually, if you think about being thrown into the fire. I mean, we've all been thrown into the fire, but at that age, that takes a lot of guts to just jump in like that, you know?
I've always been that way. I'm not saying I'm fearless, but I do. Yeah. I'll jump in, and I've done it all my life in a lot of different ways in a lot of different situations. You know, that night I took home $12, and guess what? I gave it to Willie the next day, you know? And they asked me if I could work the next weekend with them. And I said, yes, but you have to pick me up. So they came and picked me up and took me to a place on the other side of town about 35 miles away on the Friday and the Saturday night. And I made $10 each night. And back then, a kid of my age, $10 was like having, I don't know, that was, you know, that was a lot of money back then. And so I did that, and I did a few weekends with them. And next thing you know, I picked up another gig that was five nights a week. And that's another funny story. It was a strip club and, you know, a topless dancers club. And my dad had to drive me. I had a cousin who would pick me up whenever I couldn't get a ride from the bass player or the guitar player. Still didn't have a car. And one night I couldn't get a ride from my cousin, Sammy, who would come pick me up, or either the bass player or the guitar player. And my dad overheard me on the phone that I was looking for a ride. He says, "I'll drive you." I said, "It's okay, Dad. I'll be okay." I went to Catholic school for 12 years, dude. You know, so I grew up in that kind of a family. And so my dad said, "I'll drive you." And I said, "No, I'm looking." I said, "I'll drive you." And I said, "Okay." So he's driving me over there. I am peeing my pants all the way because we're going to pull up in front of a topless dancer bar, a dive topless dancer bar. And his son, who's going to Catholic school and he's paying tuition for it just to keep him out of trouble, is, you know, going to go in there where that has one of those lights around on the mobile sort of sign that had lights around back in the old days. And it said Polka Dot Lounge, topless dancers. We pull up front and my dad says, "What's this, son?" And I said, "This is my gig." You know, and he said, "They got topless dancers in there." I said, "Yeah, they do." He says, "They take the clothes off?" And I said, "Well, most of it." So they're down to a G string, and I didn't get into details. He goes, "Son, that's not right by our religion," and blah, blah, blah. And I went,
I was just going to say, did he ask you, "Can I be your tech?"
So I said, no, he didn't. But there's a tale to it. So I immediately come up with a lie. And I said, "Dad, I spoke to Father so-and-so at school, one of the priests, and I told him I was doing this."
Good
and he
save.
Said, "As long as you don't get aroused, you're going to be fine. It's not a sin." So my dad took that. He went away with it. He went for it, okay? He didn't ask me which priest or blah, 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 or followed up. And he just believed me. I go home. My aunt, who lived nearby, who was quite a character, knew that my dad was quite a character as well. And she said to my mom, she said, "Albert found out that Tony," because she knew I was there because her son was driving me over there, you know, and it was around the corner from their house. She knew I was working at a strip club, and she talked to my mom about it. Of course, now that's the gossip of the day, of the week. And then my aunt cracked up laughing, thinking about my dad being so tough with discipline and everything. She said on Thursday, she said, "Why don't you and Albert come out and go with me and her husband, LC, to see Tony play in this bar?" And my mom is, I don't think Albert's going to want to do that, you know. And but comes Friday evening, and I'm nervous as hell because I'm going, I wish they wouldn't. I don't want them. They don't need to come in. Sure enough, they show up with my aunt and uncle, and my dad's sitting there, and he was really stoic all night long, and he acted like he wasn't paying attention to it, and he didn't approve. He had a couple of beers. He talked, and when the girl came on to dance, my dad got up from the table, and I didn't know where he went, and I guess thinking he's going to the bathroom, because I'm looking at him over at the table and monitoring. He walks around the back, and I see him poke his head around a pillar, to watch the girl from really close so he could see her, so my mom couldn't see him watching the stripper. Dig, you see what's going on? So I see him and I go over on the break, and my aunt's go, "Honey, you sounded great. You sounded really great playing drums. Wow, you're good. You know. And my mom is like, she's smiling, being nice and everything. And my dad's stoic, looking the other way. And I said, "So, Dad, what do you think about that dancer?" He goes, "I wasn't watching, son. I wasn't looking."
You guys must have had a laugh about that later in life a little bit.
We
right?
did. We yeah. did. We did. I think he continued to deny it. So,
right.
The scene then was four sets a night, 4 45-minute sets a night, 8 to 12. And the drinking stopped at midnight in Texas at that point until they changed the laws to later on to 2 o'clock in the morning, which is much later. So you'd go to work and you'd play from 8 to 12 with 15-minute breaks. And the bars were hopping, man. You know, there were bars everywhere with bands in them, and the music was rhythm and blues. You had to play a little bit of country, and sometimes you had to learn to play a jazz tune or two. So, you know, I early on had to pick up brushes. I early on had to learn to play swing. I had to play, obviously had to play a shuffle. Then there were certain beats that were soul beats that I had to play on all the gigs. And then every once in a while, they'd sneak a rock and roll song in there, and they'd do maybe a top 40 or whatever the hit of the week was or the hit of the month. And we'd learn that because the club would want you to have songs that were current. So there was a real cross section. Most of the bands were mixed between African American, Mexican American, and Caucasians. And that was just normal. And that was a culture that I grew up into very easily. So then later on, when I moved and lived other places, I was always open to more cultures than just what was going on around me. And still, I am still very open to it.
Let's jump ahead a bit. I want to ask you about Electric Lady Studios. Was this your first studio session?
No, I was. One thing about it, I got early on. I got interested in playing in the studio, and there were some 8-track, and then there was a 12-track studio, and that moved to 12-track. But I remember when that studio was 4-track, and there were several others that were only 4-track. I remember one it was a 2-track, and one it was a 3-track. But by this particular time, I'm already recording on all of these tracks. You know, I would go in one day with nothing but a bunch of country guys on the 4-track studio. Papa Jones or something was his name, and Papa Charlie something, I can't remember. And he'd pay you $30, $10 an hour to cut the whole record, and you'd cut it in 3 hours, and the whole record. And one mic on the drums, one mic on a piano, steel guitar, acoustic guitar and banjo, if there was something like that, playing on the same damn microphone, upright bass over in a corner with a microphone, singer singing on a microphone. And they would all just be going into this 4-track live, and we'd record like that. I got to record very early, then the 8-track studio, and then, of course, 16-track came around, and of course, later, 24-track. So I was very early on learning how to record. So that was right up before we went to Electric Lady. So I got plenty of recording experience before I got to Electric Ladyland, which was a great place to record for me to go to my first big studio to be Electric Ladyland in New York.
What was that? Who was that with?
It was a band out of Houston called Bloontz, B-L-O-O-N-T-Z, and we got a record deal up there. Mm-hmm. And we went up there to record, and we ended up renting a house upstate New York, and like a bunch of hippie musicians, we lived in a house in a beautiful area near Pound Ridge, upstate New York.
Well, you wrote a song for Johnny Nash. Was this your kind of entry into songwriting?
I had been doing some songwriting before in Texas with the guys, and I'd had lyrics and I have an idea, or you know, because I could play a few chords on the guitar and maybe a few chords on the piano, and I sat down one day and it just popped into my head. Mm-hmm. And I'd played it for one of the guys in the band. I think I played it for Rabbit, and he loved it. And he thought it was a brilliant sort of, you know, really nice kind of gospel-y ballad. And so I played it for Johnny, and Johnny loved it. And he recorded it on the next record. That was my first trip into that gang, you know. And because of that, soon after that, when we moved to London, I continued writing for that same publisher, Johnny Nash and his partner. And
what was it like in London in the 70s, the scene there?
It was great. It was wild. It was still cool. It was, you know, it wasn't the 60s. It was, you know, it wasn't Jimi Hendrix, but the bands were coming up, and there were big rock bands and everything, and Zeppelin was going, but it was kind of the start of the end of an era, or let's say the beginning of another, not so much the end of an era, but the beginning of punk. And I'm living on King's Road in Chelsea, in a flat that the record label Island Records had given Terry Wilson and I to live in. And we were on a stipend every week, whether we worked or not, from Island Records, but we were on call to do sessions for them. And I did a lot of sessions at both Island Studios, Bathing Street and Hammersmith, and did a lot of sessions at Trident. Once people discovered that we were a Texas rhythm section, they went, oh, let's get these guys. They must have some grease, you know? And we get to play on different records for different people. And I got to work at Air Studios and Trident, and Delane Lee and Wembley, all the studios, man. I think I played at every single one of them.
When you were there, and coming from Texas and being so so much of a fan of the blues, when you were there, because did you notice or did you have any kind of experience with the British musicians that were so highly influenced by American blues music? You know, because of course Jagger and the Beatles and so many British acts were influenced by American blues. Did you see some of this?
I did, because I always took that music for granted because I grew up with it. I didn't think it was so kind of, oh, this is cool though. These guys are into blues, you know. I would run into them and I could play with them in the studio or whatever, and I could play that music and adapt to it very easily. And I hung out with some, but not really a lot of the heavier blues guys that call themselves blues guys back then, you know, the John Mayall and by then Eric Burdon was already living in the United States, and he was one of the early influences of that as well.
Sure.
And Clapton, and I didn't know Clapton then, and Hendrix was gone, and you know, so there was a bit of the blues scene still, and I got to do some of that. So there was another element, and I'm going to interrupt you. There's another element that when I was working with Johnny Nash, I was playing reggae, and I learned to play reggae in the early 70s, right before I was already interested in reggae before I got the gig with Johnny. So with Johnny, I had to play Steer It Up and I Can See Clearly Now, which isn't reggae, and a whole bunch of other songs that he had written and that Bob Marley had written as well, because Marley was signed to his publishing company and wrote for his publishing company. And so those early songs that Marley wrote were you know, handled by Johnny Nash and his manager, Danny Sims. So I got to learn to play reggae quite a bit. And then he brought four Ghanaians over that were living in London to be in the band, and three of them were horn players and one was percussionist. And at rehearsals and sound checks and stuff like that, when we were on the road with Johnny, with the Sons of the Jungle, that was half Texas, half Ghanaian band. It was amazing. What a spirit. And they would hang out, they would ask me to hang out at sound checks and stuff like that. And they would show me beats and grooves and stuff. And I was already playing reggae, my style, not deep into the Jamaican style, not like, some of those guys, but I was learning to play the African stuff as well.
You mentioned Eric Burdon a minute ago, and I think it was, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, maybe I saw you with him. So your relationship with Eric goes way back. Did that start in London?
It started in Los Angeles. I got called to play on some of his demos by the same person who I had that first gig, that first rehearsal with the band. And they were putting a band together like everybody did to do showcases, to go in the studio to record, to hopefully get a record deal. That's what you did back then. So my friend Louis Cabasa, who is still a very good friend of mine, moved back to Texas. He lived out here. He played with all sorts of great acts and R&B acts and stuff like that. And Natalie Cole, and for one. And Louis said, I got their session. We're going to cut some demos on a guy named Eric Burdon. I'm like, I know who Eric Burdon is. And we went to a home studio and recorded demos that turned into tracks that we later on went into the studio and we recorded some of and turned into an album that was released later on, unbeknownst to us. And, you know, we never got paid for the release. We got paid for the demos. And then Eric was going to do some gigs. And so through this rhythm section that was there at the session, we became his little band. And we started playing around California. We did some California dates. And it was a great piano player by the name of Ronnie Barron was playing piano from New Orleans. And I forget the bass player's name, but I didn't get on with him. And after about a half a dozen dates, I kind of suggested they get another bass player or else I wasn't sure I wanted to do it. And that's when I got Terry Wilson on the gig. And yeah, working around with Eric, we did some more recording, and then we went to Australia on a 6-week tour, which was thrilling and wonderful. And I mean, now I'm like, that's what I wanted to do, you know. And I'm over there with Mike Ruff and Snuffy Walden, oh, and Terry Wilson, and I are the 4-piece band behind.
Wow,
me.
What a band!
I know.
Wow.
And we. Did we do the movie before that? We went to Berlin and did a movie about his comeback in his life. It was really cheesy little movie, you know, and I got a real small acting part in it. And, you know, me and Snuffy got to act one morning, you know, just kind of, we improvised. There were no scripts, you know. And then we went to Australia and did that. And that was a lot of fun. And after that, I could see that the business, his management thing was getting a little dodgy because there was monies not being paid out to some people. And I got paid in cash for Australia gig. And when I realized it, I also just auditioned for Ricky Lee Jones and got the gig. So the next time they asked me to go out with Eric, I'm like, well, the business is funny. And by the way, I've got this gig with Ricky Lee Jones and it pays really good. And Warner Brothers is behind it. And it's, you know, it's steady and it's excellent. For me, that was a lot of money back then, you know,
sure.
It was over $2,000 a week. And, you know, that was high pay back then.
Was that around when her earlier hit
Chucky's records? In Love. It was right after Chucky's in Love. It was during right when she had just finished Pirates.
Okay. Oh, that's an amazing
record. We went out with a great band.
So you were touring Pirates? You were touring that music?
I was touring Pirates, yeah.
Oh, what a record.
I know. Isn't it great? Brilliant. Oh. I mean, you know, here's the deal. I had to go to school on Steve Gadd to do her gig.
Exactly.
And I'm no Steve Gadd, you know, he's brilliant. He's brilliant musician and drummer and technically just perfect and so clean and such an inspiration, but I'm listening to his parts and I had to learn his parts.
Yeah.
So after that, you know, after I had that gig and I learned some copying, once again, you're emulating somebody that's great, you know, after copying his parts and everything, I was able to apply that a little bit of that style in my playing around town and on sessions and stuff. And so I became the guy who was like a cross between Jim Keltner and Steve Gadd for a little bit.
Mm-hmm. It's a good
which
cross.
Which is not a bad combination. Right. I'm not making that distinction about myself. It's what other people said to me. You know, you're kind of right between that slinky Jim Keltner wonderful thing with his backbeat and Steve Gadd with the chops. And I went, well, thank you. There's no way I compare to either one of these guys. They're both heroes of mine. So,
well, you know, that reminds me, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you is, I mean, you're a wonderful shuffle player and you, I'm sure, know the background into that whole groove, but those two, speaking of those two guys, right. Mm-hmm. The ability to, play that loose kind of like, in between straight and shuffle feel, which is so beautiful that Keltner is so magical with, you know, and I wanted to ask you a bit about the different shuffles. You know, there's a different interpretations of the shuffle feel from Texas or from Chicago, and talk a little bit about that.
Well, if you go on YouTube, you'll see a video of me at a sound check that Andy Dorshuk did when he was still, you know, running Drum Magazine. We were up in his area, and he came over and he asked me to do a double shuffle. Now, I've taken the shuffle for granted all my life because I've been playing it since I was a kid. It's literally, seriously, one of the first beats I had to learn. And a lot of guys are still, some people struggle with a shuffle to really get it to feel good and make it sit there a certain way. And I've never had a problem with it. I'm so relaxed with it. And so I showed him the double shuffle that I did. I showed him my interpretation of a double shuffle, how I right-hand it, how I left-hand it, how I bass drum it. The variations that I use between right and left hand, you know, the triplet, the almost like dotted eighth note, 16th note kind of when you open it up, you know, or close it down, some people say, and make it broader, you know, and you learn how to swing it different ways. And I just caught it very early on. And, you know, there's a stumble shuffle, which has got that backbeat that sounds like they call it the flat tire beat, back-um, back-um, back-um. You know, and a swing shuffle, I always like to call certain sort of gospel shuffles a Motown shuffle because of the way, you know, Benji Benjamin really capitalized on it. You know, mm-hmm. He had a whole way of playing his shuffle as well. But the shuffle comes from an African beat, and you know, it's a tribal thing, and you when you hear it in some African music, and or at least hear the 6/8 going on through it, and you start to superimpose that in your mind. Sometimes just superimposing the 6/8 in your mind while you're playing it helps you find other things to play around it, or you go back and forth between the six, you know, the 6/8 and or the six feel or the triplet feel or whatever. And I've always used that in so many ways to do what I do, as long as it serves the song and not to overplay, you know. And when I'm playing a fill, I'm marking the end of a section, or I'm announcing where we're going next with my fills. And that's the way I like, you know, I always say a good drummer in an ensemble band should be a sergeant at arms.
She's got smooth long legs, curly red hair. When I look into her eyes, that you would never dare. When I see that sunlight shining through your dress, you know I'm transforming to a hell of a mess. That's what keeps me rocking. That's what keeps me rocking. That's what keeps me rocking. That's what keeps me keeping on. Hey!
Let's talk a little bit about Bonnie Raitt. You know, this is another person I saw you play with a long time ago, and you worked on Nick of Time and Luck of the Draw, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, classic records. And
you know, I have to be real honest with you. That was mostly Ricky Fattar, really. I played on Nick of Time. I played on a couple of things and two or three songs. I can't remember. Yeah. And then the second record I played on, the only thing I played on was a ballad, I Can't Make You Love Me.
Oh. Which
and Ricky played on all this other stuff. But, you know, we have similar styles. We have similar feel. That's why both of us work with Bonnie. But Ricky's the famous guy on those two records.
How did you meet her? How did you get connected with her?
I was working with Etta James down at the in Hollywood at the, what was that nightclub called? It was a jazz club. And her drummer was leaving, and someone who's playing keyboards and sax in her band, Marty Greb, who's not with us any longer, Marty suggested that I take over from the guy that was in her drummer. And so she came to see me play, and I was already talked up by several other musicians at the time that knew me. Oh, yeah, you should get Tony. He'd be just right for you. She came to see me play with it was the Vine Street Bar and Grill. She came to see me play with Etta James at the Vine Street Bar and Grill on like a Friday night. Or no, we were Monday nights. That was Monday night gig. It was one of those, you know, start the week off great. You know what I mean? With that Etta James gig. And I played and she sat there and watched it and dug it. And the craziest thing happened though that night, as I went out to my car to go into my car and to pull it around to put my drums in it or something or whatever, and it had been broken into. And so I had a bag in there, a shoulder bag, which had a back then, remember the cassette player that we had, the really good one, the professional, the Sony Pro, whatever it was, and in my phone book. And I didn't care about the tape recorder. I cared about my phone book because I always pride myself in having everybody's number. I've got everybody's number, you know, and I didn't want to lose that phone book. So I go looking around the neighborhood there, and I'm it's just off of Vine Street, you know, and I'm looking into a dumpster, and this guy came around and asked me what I was doing and got really aggressive, and I had a big black flashlight in my hand. And I thought, I said, I'm just looking for something I lost. And he's like, why are you looking here? And I said, look, man, I'm going to walk away. I'm trying to figure out whether I'm going to need to defend myself with the flashlight in my hand or whether I walk away. I'm going to walk away. I'll walk away. I'm walking away from him. And four of the guys turn the corner and they come running at me. And I got five guys chasing me over by the Motown building. It was Selma and Argyle. And they caught me. And they finally brought me down and they stood on my hand till they got the flashlight out of my hand, stomped on my hand, my right hand. And I still have a little scar there. And they took the flashlight and started beating me over the head with it. And I kind of thought, Rich, I kind of thought that might have been the night I was gone. Wow. I went, this is a funny way for the lights to go out. And they stopped. And one of them yelled at the other one, hey, stop, you're going to kill him. And they stopped.
But what was the grievance?
Nothing. I was in their neighborhood. I was on their block. There was no grievance. They just wanted trouble. Totally. And I got up and walked back over to the club, and I had blood all over my head and everything. And Bonnie didn't know this. She's already gone. And the next day I called and said, hey, I got beat up. I don't know if I can do this gig in 5 days or whatever, 4 days. So I got stitched up and everything, and I sat there and, you know, patched my wounds up for a little bit. And then I went and did a rehearsal with her and did a gig with her, like, within the next weekend.
did you ever find your book?
No. No, that was the worst part. But I recovered. I recovered pretty well. But that was a crazy story. But that's the night I got the gig with Bonnie Raitt. So Bonnie and I, we took off with this band, and we had a lot of fun, and we were making great music every night, man. Every night the band was on, you know, with great players, and Hutch Hutchinson on bass, and Johnny Lee Chell on guitar, and Marty Greb on keyboards and sax, and Ivan Neville from the Neville Brothers is playing keyboards as well. And then at the end of the 80s, like 89 or something like that, she recorded Nick of Time, and everything started coming back for her. Mm-hmm. And she got the 4 Grammys that year, and I played on the Grammys with her. And after we did the big tour after the Grammys, someone put a bug in her ear that she needed a different band. And so she got rid of all of us but the bass player. And we went on, and, you know, it was devastating. It hurt our feelings. She and I are still excellent, really, really good friends. And in fact, I went on a hike with her Monday morning up in San Francisco.
Okay.
We're still very good friends, you know.
Yeah.
Still soulful, like a brother and sister kind of type friend. So,
yeah, it's beautiful.
You know. I after that, I just, I was already, because of my recording experience, I was already a guy around town who could adapt pretty well. And she had seen me play with Ricky Lee Jones. Bonnie had. That was another thing that she saw. And I did, and the tour after Ricky Lee Jones, the next year I went out with Bette Midler and did a big major tour around the United States with Bette all over the place. And that was like a 3-hour show, you know, with dancers and the choreography and everything and costume changes. And, you know, the band even changed clothes at intermission, you know.
How did Taj Mahal come into your life?
I was doing some recording with this sort of circle of guys, this, Johnny Lee was in that, and Hutch, and Bob Glob, and different players, keyboard players around town, and Marty Greb was there, and Ian McLagan, and Bill Payne from Little Feet. We're all in the circle of people that John Porter, was an English guy, producer, liked to use a lot of us. And John would use Richie Hayward sometimes from Little Feet, or he'd use me, and I was supposed to play on half of the first Taj Mahal record, and Richie could only make like 3 songs or 2 songs one day, and I played on the rest of it. And I didn't want to leave that recording session when I was not hired, you know, once the job was complete. And I got called back because of how well that first record went to do the second Taj Mahal record. And then the first one was called Dancing the Blues. And then the second one was called Phantom Blues, and we narrowed the band down a little bit, and it had a lot, sort of a narrower. So John Cleary became the one of the keyboard players then, and Mick Weaver, and and we recorded at Cherokee, and that was the second record. And then Taj's record label wanted him to go, private records wanted him to go on tour and take a band, so they asked us, and it was less money than we really wanted to go and do, but we negotiated back and forth to where he got it up to a certain point. And I said, the guys, I was kind of doing the negotiating. And I said, here's what they're offering. I got it up as good as I could, blah, blah, blah. Let's go out and do it. And we went out as a band that, that became the Phantom Blues Band because of the title of that record. And Taj named us a Phantom Blues Band. And we went out and started touring with Taj. And that was 95, I believe. And we did it until 2002, I think, when we stopped doing it full time.
All right.
We made another record as Senior Blues, and that got a Grammy nomination and won a Grammy. And while we were out on the road enjoying the back and forth to Europe and Japan and all over the United States, big festivals, we were hot. This was a hot band at the time. We were very well respected. And when we would be at the New Orleans Jazz Festival with Los Lobos and Little Feet on the same stage the same day, I'm not saying they were scared of us, but they're going, watch this band, because these guys are not going to leave anything on the stage when they finish, you know. We were pretty powerful. And we made a live record. Ty said, instead of taking this, we got offered this one tour that the business was kind of funny. He said, I don't want to do that tour. Let's go back and make a live record. And I said, okay. I put together the whole thing at the Mint, three nights, two sets a night, and the whole recording, got the engineer, set up how we were going to record it. I wanted to do it on tape. I had two tape machines. I had a great engineer. I paid her, the late Terry Becker. She was wonderful. She did an incredible job. And so I made sure it was all recorded well, and all that we had DAT tapes running the whole time, so we didn't lose a note or a word of anything. I was looking through this file lesson. There's two file drawers over there of DAT tapes and ADATs from that gig still. And we got it done, and I took it home, and some of the guys in the band were asking what was going to happen. And so I invited them over to my house to come over to my house. There's 103 takes here. We've got to sort through this to get a live record. So I started working on these 18 songs and editing. It took a year, close to a year. I took all of the dialogue in between the tracks and manufactured speeches that were the right amount of length, the right thing to say before the next song, the right thing after from the song before. I found all these pieces that Taj had spoken. They were out of his mouth, but I edited this whole thing together with an engineer. I ended up finishing the record and got Taj in at the end of it, and he re-sang three songs. And I'm nervous here. I'm producing Taj Mahal. I'm going to get Taj to re-sing. I mean, I'm Taj, do you want all of these vocals the way they are? No, I want to redo those three there. And okay, well, we got 18 tracks here. We need to pick like 12 or whatever. I was down to 15 at that point. I've got the licensing things all worked out already with the record label, the moratorium of not being able to record certain songs within 7 years, blah, blah, blah. And Taj picked 12 songs, and we finished those the next 2 days. I got it mixed and mastered. It came out, and they got a Grammy nomination and won a Grammy. My first Grammy as a producer.
Producing from the drummer's point of view, from our vantage point, I mean, you know, some of our favorite producers are drummers, you know, so it's and you've been doing this now for a long time, and you really, I know we've talked over the years about how much production you're doing, but don't you think there's a strength that we have from that point, from the conductor's point, so to speak, you know, as a producer, to and also rhythmically, of course, and how we, you know, see the whole picture, you know.
I completely do. I think that, well, one, we are the conductor. As I said earlier, we're the sergeant arms. We kind of snap a finger and it goes here, and we play this and it goes there. And I find that I learn to produce from behind the drum chair, is the way I say it to people. People go, can you produce and play at the same time? I said, I prefer, unless I'm not the right drummer for the gig. I prefer producing and playing at the same time. And because if I go in and I've got another drummer, it's not that I don't feel like telling them how to approach something. It's when I get to the point where I have to tell them what to play, then I feel uncomfortable and I think I should be on the drum kit, you know, and especially if it's my responsibility as a producer, you know, to make this sound really good. And I've had mostly really good experiences when I've used other drummers. It's been okay. And then I've gone in and I've literally at the tail end of a record after using another drummer, because the artist wanted that drummer, their drummer in their band or whatever to play in it, that I always say, you know, there's a difference of playing live and playing in the studio, and the people who know how to record and have that touch, it's knowing how to print. If you know how to print, you know, and you got good time, decent time, and you can play to a click track and you understand the dynamics and the touch of the drums in the studio, then I can see it. But if not, no, you should use some, you don't, you know. So I produce some people who tell their bands, no, the producer is going to say who's going to be on the record. And then I have some people that I produce that go, no, I want my band. And I understand you go out there on the road and work behind that artist and pay those dues, you know, all of those thousands of miles. You want to have something in it, but it doesn't always turn out to be the best record. I've been fortunate in that experience, and that I've never had a really terrible experience with that, you know. But I have, as I was going to say, gone in and changed the drum track before the record was finished, because I went back and I'm going, I'm sorry, I can fix this drum track, it's on a click, and I can play with the band right now and fix the track. And I've done that several times. And I'd rather not have to do it, I'd rather just do it myself. But it works both ways. For me, when I'm sitting on the chair, I hear everybody and everything they're playing. You know that as a drummer. You're listening, man, because you're paying attention to everybody. And if you're not, then you're not the drummer I want. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That you should be in a band.
That's right.
You need to be listening to the whole band. You gotta make everybody sound good. Everybody, you know, especially the vocalists. You've got to play to a certain feel and cadence and temperament to the beat and everything, that so that it fits that vocal. So that person's phrasing, you know, makes sense. You know, you can make them sound good by playing a certain way, by really listening close. Yeah. So that's the way I approach it.
Let's talk a little bit about tools of the trade, because, you know, your relationship with Gone Bops and Sabian goes back quite a ways. And, you know, from a drummer and a producer's point of view, looking at colors and sounds that you get to choose from.
I love Gone Bop stuff. I love how it's made. It's simple. It's straight ahead. Everything that Gone Bop makes feels good and sounds good, and it's made well. You know, there are other companies out there that are doing a great job. Don't get me wrong, but I'm having a great time with Gone Bop, and my relationship with Sabian is how I ended up being lucky enough to have this relationship with Gone Bop, and lucky enough to have you as a friend, you know, working with me, you know, in my endorsement of this product. And no, this stuff sounds great. I mean, I'm using a Cajon all the time, and now because of the shutdown and everything, it's like people are putting on these small things and you know, like getting together and 20 feet apart, and you know, I've got a Cajon and, you know, or a tambourine or something like that. My friend Arnellis had a set of Gone Bops, old Gone Bop congas, and I had them for years because he wasn't interested in them, and they had a crack in one of them, but still we played it had a little crack, and I kept the Gone Bop congas for years. And when I would get called to play on a recording session, they ask, can you play congas? I go, I can give you a conga part. Yeah. I'm not a conga player, like, you know, the cats, you know what I mean, you know. So I'm not gonna give you a Lenny Castro conga part, you know. But I can get, but I would take them to sessions, and because sometimes people just want them, that's all they want. Right. You know, they don't want any, you know, crazy part on their record. And so I use those Gone Bops and I love them. Then one day Willie goes, yeah, I think I want them back. And I went, oh, you jerk, you know? And we always had this thing where we would borrow something from each other and then never give it back.
Did he get them back, or do you still have them?
No, I had to give them back to him later on, and I ended up with another brand of congas, which I bought from another friend who was with the other company, and I, that's, you know, but so I ended up with those for a while. But I'm still playing some timbales and some great shakers, and the new tambourines are fantastic. And the tambora thing is mm-hmm. good, and that can that looks like a
bucket.
The Bucket is fabulous, man. The Bucket, Shaker Ray, is, yeah, is so cool, man.
No matter what I do, because we ain't got nothing but fun. I want to tell everybody about this poor boy's dream. Don't be surprised if things are better than they seem. Yes, I'm Mr. Lucky, put your mind at ease. When I need a little love and I don't have to say please, that's what keeps me rocking. That's what keeps me rocking.
You know, in closing today, I wanted to, you mentioned something about our current state of affairs and working and trying to keep some work coming in. So I wanted to hear your take on how things are going lately and how you're keeping things rolling, you know, in this kind of a situation, which is, you know, so many of our friends, unfortunately, have lost so much work. But I wanted to know how things are for you and kind of how you're keeping things rolling and your experience keeping recordings going or productions or your workload, you know?
There's an artist I produced that we finished the record last year, and we've got a record deal, and they were going to release it in February of 2020, and they put it off and put it off and put it off. And in May, they asked me to go in and do a single, and I went in the studio in a big room, and I told everybody beforehand, we all wore masks, and I wore gloves and two masks that day. And I just produced. I didn't play, and we all kept our distance, and we cut the single. And I was kind of scared, and I got a videotape of it as well because the record label wanted a video of it, obviously. And I did that in May, and then I've gone into the studio with my friend Johnny Lee, and just he and I, one on one, to finish up this other record that I started at the end of 19, and yet another one that I started at the end of 19. So all of those projects have been finished. One was finished in July, and the other one is about to be finished. I'd say it's finished. We're going to go in and change one thing and then redo the mixes. I've got a Taj Mahal record that Larry and I and the Phantom Blues Band have been doing for 5 years, and we're almost done with that. And we're doing what we can remotely as well. And that's why I've gone ahead and upgraded my studio situation so that I can handle more really high quality remote recording right here. But I don't know how this is going to come back. I will say this. I think everybody really needs to like start really soul searching themselves, find out really who they are and work at that and work on that. So when this does come back, we can all focus and we don't just, you know, wait at the gate and run crazy at one time and run over each other, you know, get out there and really organize things and make things really work.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that by the springtime, well, before, I'm hoping that some of this comes back where we can safely get in the studio with a little bit larger group of people. I say write positive songs.
Yeah.
I know you're going to be depressed because of this. I say you try to find the bright side of it.
Yep.
This is my message to people. Look at the bright side of what you're going. Write about your darkness, but look at the contrast that you get in your heart and your soul by realizing that darkness is not really going to overcome you. It's just hanging out there all the time. And write some positive songs and get ready for it, you know, and practice your acts a little bit more and maybe sit down and learn to play another instrument, you know. Do something positive and stay in shape and eat healthy.
Exactly.
You know? And do things to keep your brain going. And, you know, I play golf. That's my little sanity break. Mm-hmm. Right there, you know.
Yeah.
And I go away for 5 hours and play golf and I come back and I feel wonderful.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Tony, thank you for joining us today and doing this. This was great.
It's Rich, man. I'm smiling, man. Thank you very much, man. I really appreciate you. It was great talking to you. We could have gone on forever.
Yes, we could. And just fantastic to hear, you know, your take on it all. And we really appreciate it, you know, you being a part of our family, too. It is a family, as you well know. And we really appreciate having you. So thank you.
Thank you, and thank the family.
I will. Everybody, stay tuned for more episodes coming up, and we will keep you abreast of things on our website and our social media. And again, thanks to Tony Bronigal today, and we will see you all very soon. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.